You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture, Second Chances Edition 2024. I'm joined here by Matt. Good morning, Matt.
Hello, Sam.
And we are going to talk, as usual in those Second Chances episodes, about a movie each that somehow we didn't care for so much, or we had a very strange first encounter with, or we swore that we would never watch it again, something like that of that kind. And today it's going to be two musicals. I'm going to say two very special entries into the musical film category. And I think for that it's necessary to kind of first talk about our take towards musicals. How do we feel about musical films in general? And what are maybe some of our favorites? And how does that rank in our usual experience of films? So, Matt, tell us about your relationship to musicals.
I think I've probably written about my relationship to musicals a couple of times on the blog. I had this thing where when I was a kid, and I really mean a kid, you know, 10 or 12 years old, I used to think I did not like musicals, while at the very same time when I grew up, there were several musicals that I'd watched that I liked a lot. I know that, you know, for instance, my dad had the old vinyls of Jesus Christ Superstar, Cats, and all of that, and I enjoyed listening to those. I also very much liked some of the films, like for instance Oliver. When I was a kid, I watched that and I really, really liked it. I loved Hair. So there was this weird contradiction where I thought I don't like musicals, but there are some that I like in spite of being musicals. I think my problem was, as a kid, I simply couldn't contextualize what a musical was enough. The form, the format, the stylization. For instance, when I was 12, I found the jazz ballet dancing gang members of West Side Story silly because gang members don't dance ballet. And I think I had to become more experienced with different non-naturalistic styles, not just in film, but also in literature. I think to some extent, reading Shakespeare, working on Shakespeare at university, helped me understand musicals because Shakespeare is not realistic. People don't speak in iambic pentameter, but I started to understand better how you can have a heightened form. And that heightened form might be more artificial on the one hand, but that artifice can also be used to convey authentic emotion in, as I said, a heightened way. And I think musicals do that. So I think musicals, very often they wear their hearts on their sleeves. So you've got a certain, at least attempt at authentic emotion, but they're also very, very formalized. Obviously, they're very artificial. And to me at the time, the artifice felt like an affectation, but I think I've become more aware of where it works for me and where it doesn't. What about you?
Yeah, I think that hyperrealism was also an issue for me, partly when I was never able to tell myself that I really loved musicals. So I really share that experience with you. Even though I used to say I'm not into musicals that much, there were a number of musicals that I really liked. And one of them was West Side Story, also because my grandparents had the vinyl and I used to listen to it as a kid. I was very familiar with the songs. Seeing the film, I also had this sense of I liked it, but it was somehow very unrealistic, including the dancing, including the heightened emotion between Tony and Maria. But I love the music that went along with it. And I think that followed up with other films that I saw. I'm thinking of Cabaret. I'm thinking of Victor Victoria, which were films that I really liked. But I seem to tell myself that I didn't like them because they were musicals, but just because they had great performances, you know, Liza Minnelli and Julie Andrews. Then came Sound of Music later on. And I thought, well, I don't like the musical aspect of it, the silly breaking into songs and dance suddenly. But I kind of like the songs. They're very catchy. And of course, I love the performance of, you know, the main star, for instance. I thought it was about personality much more than about the genre. And then I caught myself, obviously, also, you know, Disney films that are very often or have the musical format, which have great songs, very memorable music. And I thought, well, in a way, I love musicals. Once I saw stage musicals, I said, okay, yeah, I do love, you know, Phantom of the Opera on stage. I do like Les Miserables or Hamilton on stage, but I don't think I would love them as movies. So there was this odd, ambivalent or ambiguous relationship that I had with musicals as well, ever since I started watching them. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. with me, it was really very much like you said. I felt, you know, I like these films, some of these films like Jesus Christ Superstar, Fiddler on the Roof, My Fair Lady. I like them in spite of being musicals. That's what I thought. But then once you have had to say that a couple of dozen times, I think it's time to say, yeah, probably I do like a good musical. But yeah, then you get to the distinction, what is a good musical? What is a bad musical? And I've definitely become also just much more comfortable with, to some extent, the camp of it. I think as a kid, probably like so many kids growing up in a, in the end, patriarchal, heteronormative society, I felt uncomfortable with this camp thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I wouldn't have gone so far as to, you know, as a kid think, oh, that's so gay. But there was probably a touch of that. There was probably an element of that, if I'm perfectly honest with it. And I think at this point in time, I think, so camp is just one of many styles, and it can be highly effective and it can be highly annoying like any other style.
Absolutely. And going back to Victor Victoria, I think me growing up, that was probably one of the first films where I saw gay themes as well, mm-hmm. in a film that was not, you know, tragic and not super involved in terms of the telling of the initial plot. But it was there, and it was fun. It was camp. It was on stage. And I think me, you know, growing up kind of in the closet, that would be a very important film for me, mm-hmm. seeing that and having the fun and the music at the same time. I think, yeah, there's something emancipatory as well as mm-hmm. about them.
Yeah, I mean, even without that aspect, I think there's something emancipatory in realizing that film or any kind of medium doesn't have to be narrowly realistic, because even what we look at as realistic in film very often isn't. It's just what we're used to. So I think that the freshness, the strangeness, even I guess the queerness of the format just made for, you know, something new and original very often compared to, you know, plodding Hollywood realism.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Plus you could hum the tunes at the same time and, you know, keep them with you for years to come.
Totally.
So today we're also going to talk about two musicals. I'm going to frame them as kind of odd entries into the musical genre. That's the impression I got from watching them, either for the first time or again. And Matt, you brought one musical along that you have a very torn relationship with, as I felt. Can you tell us what it is and what was your initial relationship to that musical film?
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the ones that I'm pretty sure I saw it on TV when I was 12, perhaps 13. And at the time, I very much disliked it. It was A Chorus Line, the film by Richard Attenborough. It's based, I think, on a 70s musical, but the film, I think, is very, very, very 80s. I mean, the aesthetic of the film is very much early to mid 80s. And so is its idea of attractive. And I think to some extent, that's what put me off as a kid. I mean, this will sound weird and pretentious for an 80s kid, but I just found this, you know, the leotards, the blondest beautiful, the kind of this very American idea of what is beautiful and sexy. It was in your face in a way that I found really annoying. It also, of course, has camp and queerness. And again, I could imagine that I think I possibly was uncomfortable with the queerness of it, with the gay aspect, because it is a world, you know, musical theater that is stereotypically seen as very also often gay. Lots of gay men, and the characters in the film also state, you know, I'm one of the only heterosexuals, which kind of, I would imagine as a 13-year-old, I didn't know what to do with that. At the same time, you say it's an unusual musical. At the time, because I hadn't seen that many musicals, it felt very much like this is what musicals are like. You know, people break into song, people dance. There's a campness to it all, even though I didn't know the word at the time. So I had this idea that it was a very prototypical musical, even though it's not particularly true, especially looking at the musicals of the 1960s and 70s. But at the same time, there's the content, you know. I think there are lots of musicals also in the 40s, 50s, which are very meta, you know. They're about dancers and singers and putting on a show. And you've got that here as well. So that was my first impression. I didn't like it at the time. What about you? When did you first see it and what was your impression?
I literally saw it last week for the very first time. I had never seen A Chorus Line. It was one of those types of musicals, including Rent and Fame, that I often mixed up, didn't quite know which was which, never really saw in full, and never really cared to watch, like to seek out and to finally see. So this was a first for me. And well, it was I can definitely see the total 80-ness of it. And I can totally see how that would have been in your face at the time and maybe still looks like this. So I have my first impression literally from a few days ago, mm-hmm. which is interesting, but I think I want to hear from you. First of all, you rewatched it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how did that differ now coming back to it?
I mean, I have to admit, it's kind of the third chance. I'm pretty sure, because my wife really loves it, so I'm pretty sure that, I don't know, perhaps 10 years ago or so that we watched it, but probably at the time I was already more comfortable with musical, but the second time didn't leave that much of an impression. It's the third time this surprise happened.
So oh, dear.
No, it didn't. I would say that my second chance's impression of the film is it's entertaining. It's got some catchy tunes. It's got quite a few nice performances, if you accept them for what they are. And if you're into that kind of dancing and aesthetic, the leotards and the 80s and over it all, it's very easy to like. It's an extremely affable film. But what I also thought was that in the material, there would be a much better film than what we get, because what we get is very much... It's essentially toothless, and it's kind of fake in its affability, because I think the material is very much about a world that is toxic in many ways. You know, this world of musical theater, of the chorus lines, all these people who are hungry for a career, very few of them will make it. And even the ones who will make it, they will ruin their joints at the age of 30, 35. It's one of those prototypical films about show business, where show business is what people dream of, but it's also what will destroy them. And that is given lip service to, but not more than that. And that's why I think it's toothless.
I was surprised to see it in the sense of its simplicity. I mean, I can see how as a stage musical, the idea of having just literally this line of people wanting to be in the show that Michael Douglas's character is producing is attractive, because on stage that really works. You can bring out the different characters. You can have them have their moments on stage. I just felt as a film, it was so bare bone, just that. And then going into those characters, I felt I was not really into any of the characters on stage, nor into their songs or their stories that they're performed. And I thought it was a very odd dynamic that existed throughout the film with Michael Douglas in the semi-dark making comments, you know, godlike voices over like judging them and sometimes destroying them or criticizing them or, mm-hmm. or praising them. And having that dynamic go on for the whole film, including a love interest that I think they just added for the film version for Michael Douglas, an ex-girlfriend that wants to apply to be in the show as well. I thought it was very an uncomfortable watch. Also to think from a present point of view, obviously, you know, having that dynamic show business is basically a guy over a microphone telling you if you're any good. Mm-hmm. And then you leave either for the next show or your career is somehow tainted and destroyed because you didn't make it. And then in the end, it's just all about his appraisal of you. You know, will you make it on the show? Will he be happy? It felt very jarring to watch this. Mm-hmm. For the first time from a 2024 point of view. Not sure if you felt that too. Did you have a difference that you felt in terms of these dynamics?
I think I felt a variation of what you're saying. I definitely see what you're saying, but I also think that is where the film could have been so much more interesting. I think I first watched All That Jazz, the Bob Fosse film, about 6-7 years ago, and I think it portrays a very similar world at a very similar time. Of course, it's from the perspective of the choreographer guy, the director, the god figure. So it's very different. And Bob Fosse obviously is also a very different character. But there are still similarities there. And I think someone like Bob Fosse in All That Jazz was able to bring out that ambivalence, the toxic element, the people dream of this, people need this, but at the same time, this is what grinds people under. Whether you make it or not, you're going to be destroyed to some extent. And as I said, I think it's sometimes there in the lyrics, but you don't feel it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just too harmless. So I think similarly, perhaps that's also where some of your discomfort comes from, that it's there in the setup with Michael Douglas as the god figure being able to basically do thumbs up, thumbs down, like in a gladiator mm-hmm. movie, but it doesn't really commit to what this means. It doesn't commit to the implications of that. And I think that makes it feel more fake to me. That mm-hmm. makes it feel like, you know, it doesn't understand what the material is. And from what I've heard about the stage version, from what I've read, it is prettied up. It is made more harmless. It is made into more of a commodity. And I think that is one thing that I really have problems with musicals that basically first and foremost make themselves into a commodity. This is material that can be fun, but it shouldn't be pleasant because the setup is not one that is pleasant.
And there is a huge difference, I think, between people's appreciation of the stage musical from what I've read and the film, which many people who love the musical, who saw it repeatedly on Broadway, really hate the film because they say, A, the inclusion of Michael Douglas and the love interest story somewhat ruins it or is unnecessary. Plus, for me, it was so uncomfortable watching Michael Douglas in that role. I had just seen him in Fatal Attraction and Basic Instinct in the last few weeks before watching A Chorus Line. And I know that this is before he got that late 80s sleazy guy image, all-American Wall Street guy, but it was so uncomfortable to watch him in that role. And I think the other thing is that people say that the characters came out much better in the stage version as individuals with their songs, with their stories, and with a lot of the themes that you mentioned before, being queer and applying for these shows repeatedly, seeing those kind of characters for the first time on stage, having them talk about their stories. There's also a much more irreverent use of language in the stage version that they somehow tamed for the film. And I feel the mix of that must have felt very disappointing to fans of the musical. And I think that's the discomfort that one feels watching the film, as opposed to listening to the stage musical, which I did after watching the film. I wanted to hear what does it sound like, because in addition to that, I also felt the music didn't have an impact on me. The songs didn't really speak to me, and there were not really so many standout songs. I mean, there's one, this big final number that is very famous, of course, but I thought this Marvin Hamlisch music must be better. And it was better listening to it in the stage version. It packed a punch musically and with the lyrics that had not been, or the songs that sometimes had not been in the film. So I think that's some of the things that I felt, big differences between what the show was and what the film is.
Yeah. I mean, the things that you say, I totally agree with. I think with the characters, the thing is that everyone is a type. No one is really a character and they're relatively shallow types. And the thing is, musicals, like, for instance, a genre like romantic comedy, you very often work with types. You very often work with stereotypes, archetypes, even cliches. But in order to really work, in order to be really good, you might have a musical that has a type that still becomes a character that is both. That is both the archetype, but also feels real, feels genuine. And that is not something that ever happens in A Chorus Line, the film. So I would agree with you. Basically, I come away from it feeling I've watched caricatures, and sometimes these caricatures are fun. I think, you know, Audrey Landers' tits and ass song, it's fun, but it doesn't leave any impact, again, because there's nothing below it. And what you say about the irreverence of the material, I agree. It feels like it's been mainstreamed for a middle-of-the-road 80s audience that probably doesn't really watch that kind of stuff. That for them, it might be radical, but for anyone who's a bit more in the material, they will think, no, this is actually a blander version of something that used to be more interesting. What I also think is, there is an interesting contradiction in the material in that, as I said, musicals by definition have artifice. You know, people break into song. Obviously, in an audition for musical theater, you have a certain realism to that. If you audition, obviously you're going to dance, you're going to sing, but still you have the artifice of the musical format. At the same time, you've got Zach, the choreographer, asking all of them to be authentic. He doesn't want the cliches. He wants their real stories. And that could be interesting, this contrast between the artifice and the authentic, except the authenticity is not something I ever feel in this film. It always feels like, it feels like an audition piece for the mainstream audience. It feels like the movie goes, like me, isn't this fun? And if it's the characters doing that with a certain sense of desperation, because that's what they are, they want to be liked, they want to be considered great, they want to be in the show. So you can have that desperate need to be liked, to be approved. But that desperation is not really there. That, as I said, it's mentioned in the lyrics, but you never feel that these people are desperate, or very, very, very rarely.
And what comes down to is you have to adapt somehow to what the guy at the microphone wants, and then you'll be successful. And I think that's a very 80s concept. I'm thinking of, you know, you want to belong to that 80s society. You want to rise up in the ranks. You want to make it mm-hmm. on Broadway. So what do you have to do? You have to do what the guy at the microphone wants from you. And I think that even goes into the love interest, Cassie. I mean, she is treated horribly in the film. She comes and tries to audition several times. She's sent away. She comes back. She basically humiliates herself in front of Michael Douglas for him then to send her off again and to have her kind of breakout song. But there is no emancipation in this film. There's no one who really stands up to the guy at the microphone and, you know, really exposes the power he has over all these people. And at the end, they dance in that one number perfectly in line. And I'm thinking, so what have we been told in this film? Mm-hmm. That's really, I mean, I rarely had such an adverse reaction to a piece that felt so dated. Mm-hmm. But I could see, looking at Wall Street, looking at Fatal Attraction, looking at these stories that seem to reaffirm male dominance and the family values and the things you have to do in order to be successful, to follow the rules. I can see that in that film so strongly. I just didn't expect it. I thought it would be much more, maybe breaking with that and also exposing some of that. And I think a Chorus Line 2024, if they redid that, that's what would have to be the main difference. How do you break away from this line in a way?
Mm-hmm. And I mean, that final set piece, the whole song One, is one that I think very clearly highlights where my problem lies with Richard Attenborough's adaptation of this material. It comes up twice. First, you've got it as a rehearsal while Cassie is basically trying to ask for an audition for a part in the Chorus Line, where Zach, the choreographer, says, no, you're a star, you're not one of the Chorus Line members. So both kind of praising her, but by praising her, telling her, sorry, you don't have a chance. Mm-hmm. And in that first rehearsal version, the way it's done, the way it's kind of put on screen, made me think to some extent of something like Cabaret, where you've got a queasiness to it all, because basically the dancers in that rehearsal, they're presented as puppets. They lose all individuality. They lose all humanity. It's almost, it feels like, I don't know, it feels like a kind of queer Pinocchio version. They're almost like puppets on strings. And there the idea is really, for once, quite explicitly in the film, you know, being in the Chorus Line means that you basically strip yourself of all individuality. You have to be one of many. You cannot stand out, because standing out distracts from the mass scene. So you've got that, but then you've got the final scene where he's basically told four people, you're it, you've been chosen, everyone else hasn't been chosen, which is horrible for everyone else. But then the final set piece still brings up every single character, their role in their Chorus Line. And of course, it is probably meant as a fantasy, but that fantasy at the end shows them all as individuals. They got kind of small bits where they sing and dance in a way that highlights their character again, or their stereotype again. But the way it's done, you don't know, is it a fantasy? Is it the final show? It comes across as all of these dancers, they got what they wanted. They got their, you know, shiny spot in the limelight. And it should actually be, no, they didn't. So there's a contradiction. It's like the film is aware that this is about not getting chosen, and then it still shows everyone getting chosen. And that doesn't make sense. It only makes sense if you want to do a, hey, here's a fun, cool set piece. Don't mind the context. Don't mind what it means, because it means nothing.
Yeah, it kind of evaporates the whole part of the film that you watched before, mm-hmm. right? I didn't get what was happening. I thought, okay, so, I mean, all these characters have been kicked out. Now I get to see them on stage. So what is that scene even? And I wonder, you know, in the musical, apparently it's also the final number, but there, I think the tradition of bringing everybody back on stage has a different meaning, mm-hmm. right? It's also about the show that you've been watching, that the people maybe you liked, and then everybody comes back on stage. But in a film, trying to kind of tell the end of a story, it seemed confusing to me too. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain very annoying repetitiveness in that song as well. You know, it's a famous tune, and I think it's pretty much the only one that I knew from a Chorus Line that I had heard before. Noticeably, there are not a lot of songs that have become big classic numbers in, you know, best of musicals, I think. I didn't recognize more than one or two tunes, I think, from hearing it before. So there's also a certain conveyor belt feel to it, I'm going to say. You know, people are put out one by one. The song repeats and repeats and repeats. and is catchy, but also, yeah, jarring is the thing that comes to mind. Mm-hmm. With the golden top hats and then music playing and then the film ending like this, I was just left perturbed. I thought, wow, this was annoying and jarring, not very memorable in terms of the musical or the characters. And what I noticed is that besides Michael Douglas and maybe Audrey Landers, none of those people who were in the chorus line really seemed familiar. None of them made careers off of this, I think. Mm-hmm. So I also wonder what the cultural impact of A Chorus Line, the film, really was, mm-hmm. contrary to many other 80s musicals that I think brought out stars and songs and very memorable moments that people can still, you know, quote today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, totally. And I mean, I still think that Richard Attenborough was the wrong person for this. He could make this an affable film, absolutely. He could make it kind of enjoyable on a surface level. But you needed someone who could basically give this material its teeth back. Again, I'm thinking of Bob Fosse. You know, you can have that fantasy sequence at the end, but then you have to still kind of make clear this is a fantasy. This is not what happens. This is what the characters dream of, but it's explicitly only possible in a fantasy. Have you seen All That Jazz?
I haven't.
Okay.
No, not yet.
Do you mind if I spoil just one tiny bit there?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. I mean, there's this basically one final musical sequence that is a fantasy explicitly, it's clear. And it's fun, but it's also feverish. There's almost something delirious about it. And then there's harsh cut from that to the main character being zipped into a body bag, which is what the film has been leading up to. It doesn't come as a surprise, but in that moment, it comes as a shocking surprise because you're in the fantasy and then, dak, here's what's really happened. Obviously, that's relatively obvious. You don't need to do it exactly like that. But I think that's something I would have wanted, something at the end to acknowledge, you know, there's the dream, there's the reality, and the two very rarely meet. And even when they do, it's not as easy as that. And that's not what Attenborough does.
And isn't that one of the power of musicals, that they can put us into that dream fantasy world, great musical numbers, but then they can break away from it and contrast it with something else. Very often, I think the imagination of one of the characters of what they could be and then maybe achieving it, making it, that is the story of what a great musical can be and you know, the dramatic or the comedic sense. And I think that this, yeah, maybe it's Attenborough, but maybe I just felt that the filmmakers didn't really have a sense for that. It mixes together, it's a mashup, and it felt very, very stagey, as if they had just filmed whatever was supposed to be there on stage and what people maybe expected from the musical that they had seen. And it didn't really make these clear distinctions between fantasy and real life. Felt very one by one, mm-hmm. until the very end.
Absolutely.
Maybe that is a nice lead over to the other film we're going to talk about, the other musical we're going to talk about. If I think of like fantasy versus reality and the character dreaming up a reality that really isn't there, I think that also connects very strongly to the film that I brought along, which is a movie from 2000, Dancer in the Dark by Lars von Trier. Not exactly the musical director you would expect either. And it's a film that I saw when it came out. I swore myself never to watch it again at the time. Yet for this Second Chance episode, I said, well, I guess it is one of those films that I feel so strongly or felt so strongly about never wanting to watch it again, that maybe this is a good chance and an interesting opportunity. Matt, did you also see Dancer in the Dark when it came out in 2000?
I didn't see it at the cinema because at the time, I think I didn't really know Lars von Trier. I just knew I had several friends who hated some of the stuff he'd done over the last couple of years. So I didn't go and see it at the cinema. I saw it probably a year or two later on possibly even video at the time or DVD. And at the time, I didn't much like it. I found it, I mean, weird, obviously, but weird can be interesting. But I found it didn't come together. For me, there were all these disparate pieces that felt very separate, and each individual one could have done something interesting, but it just felt too, it didn't feel like more than the sum of its parts. It felt like less than the sum of its parts. It also, I found it overly and overtly manipulative in ways I didn't like. And the overall effect was that I mean, it obviously does the Brecht thing. It tries to give you this distancing effect, and it does totally. Except I think the distancing effect for me works best when you can both achieve it and overcome it at the same time. And this film doesn't overcome it. It didn't at the time when I first watched it. I came away from it feeling that, no, this is all fake in a way that I find kind of off-putting. Even if there were impressive individual efforts in it, absolutely. Even at the time I could have said, that scene is done really well. That edit is done really well. That performance really works for me. But it just didn't add up to anything whole and coherent for me. What about you?
I remember being completely destroyed after watching the film. And I was at the cinema where the lights went up and then everybody was like in tears. And I felt very much with everybody around it. I thought that film did something to me that was both shattering, but that I will never want to experience again. The type of a maelstrom that takes you down to the worst possible outcome and you are led there and left there and then that's it and then the lights go up. And I think manipulation is probably the word that came to mind later on as well. Somehow the film brought me to that point where I didn't want to go and I had to watch it up until that point where I felt that way. And I somehow felt, not cheated, that's the wrong word, but someone exposed me to things without any safeguards or that you sometimes expect from films, you know, especially musicals, that somehow it's going to be all right in the end, or they give you some kind of uplifting message. And obviously at the time there was people doing the Dogma style films. Lars von Trier was already a household name, together with some other films that we had seen in the late 90s also adopting that dogma. And I just felt, no, and I don't want to see that movie ever again, because it started somewhere and it went through consequentially to the very most negative outcome, and that was it. And somehow I felt cheated. That was the feeling I had at the time. Even though I said, no, the parts were great. I loved Björk in it. I thought the music was powerful at times. I thought it was very interesting the way the musical numbers were done. I had watched it with dread and, you know, involvement in the film. So all the things that I would associate with a great film, but still something had happened that I really, really didn't like.
Mm-hmm. I mean, what you say about the involvement, I think that is something that totally didn't work for me when I first saw it and still didn't work for me now. I think because it is so clearly designed to, you know, go from bad to worse and end at the worst possible point, it never feels real. And I would agree with you that Björk's performance is a strong one. But it almost feels like, you know, it doesn't feel like it's a part of the whole thing, of the world, because the story is so artificially melodramatic. I mean, it feels like a 20s silent movie melodrama where someone is kind of accused innocently or is guilty, but for reasons that you can understand. And obviously it has to end with that character being, you know, put on the electric chair or in the gas chamber or whatever. It's a format that is so much on rails in its negativity that it felt totally artificial to me in a way that I just couldn't believe. It then felt like this has nothing to do with the world out there. This has nothing to do with real people. And artifice doesn't have to mean that something doesn't relate to the real world, but it has to be handled well for artifice to feel real. And this one doesn't. It really feels like this is Lars von Trier misery porn 20s melodrama following exactly the story beats that you'd get on a Wikipedia page for that.
Wow, that's strong, but so true. And seeing him in interviews about the film just after rewatching it now, I mean, that rings so true. Basically, he said about, you know, liking musicals a lot, talking about Singing in the Rain and other examples where there was always this comedic style, the lightness of these Hollywood musicals of the 50s and 60s. And then him intentionally saying, let's make this as melodramatic as possible. How can we do the same thing with the same musical triggers, but let's make this into a very dramatic story and not take it from better to best, but really from bad to worst. And yeah, you know, if you say it's on rails, that really rings true with one of the musical numbers as well. He put those things on those rails and then filmed them from the most unusual perspectives possible. But basically, it's only going in one direction. And this time around, I was more watching out for the manipulation. How does it happen? How do we go from this to the next point to the next point? And yeah, it felt very obviously planned out to the very last detail, and how we're meant or made to feel a certain way about Björk first, about the fate that she's surrounded by, about her son, her going blind, her being at the factory, things going from bad to worse there at work as well. Then the thing about the money with her neighbors that are basically benevolent people that then turn out to be also really bad people to her in so many different ways, and how that is unstoppable. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, that the railway, obviously, image works so well. This fate is unstoppable. She goes blind, the neighbor goes to cheat her, and she can, of course, not bring herself to say anything about it that anyone would believe. She has to flee. She will be picked up, but then she loses herself in that musical dream world. But then the rails are still going towards the most horrible finale, you know, at the execution, the most horrible way it's going to happen. And I felt annoyed. I had to watch the film literally on 1.5 speed sometimes, mm-hmm. because I couldn't wait for it to be over. That's how I saw how it was happening and how it was done, but it was still somewhat not bearable to watch it. And yeah, I still felt so strongly about this manipulation mm-hmm. by von Trier.
Yeah. For me, it really is too many disparate elements. I could imagine the contrast that he works with. I mean, he is a very effective filmmaker, and you have that in this film too. Like, as you said, the horrible execution scene, just as a scene, it's very effectively done. It, in a way, does exactly mm-hmm. that contrast, that almost shocking contrast that I mentioned was missing in a chorus line. It does that very well. Again, it's just that it feels like it's being done to a cheaply manipulative effect for me. You know, I reread some of the reviews at the time and they said, oh, this is a strong anti-capital punishment film. And I have to say, for me, it doesn't work as that, because it's so clearly designed to reinforce opinions that people already hold. And that just, no, that doesn't work. You know, I think in that respect, I'd rather go and rewatch something like In Cold Blood, which has a very similar ending in a way, but there it feels of one piece. So here, I think the contrast, it could work if there weren't too many contrasts at the same time. You've got, on the one hand, the silent movie style melodrama where everything is big and the characters are not really characters, they're ideas, they're types, they're collections of plot points. So you've got that. Then you've got Dogma 9-to-5 style, almost realism, where a lot of the spoken scenes are improvisation. That doesn't really work. It doesn't feel real. It just feels flat. You've also got the low-budget handheld camera, natural lighting, grimy quality. So you've got one kind of artifice, another kind of realism, but then you've got the musical sequences, which are a flight from reality, and then you've got the political aspect of the anti-capital punishment. It feels like he threw everything in there that he could. If he just had the grimy realism of the Dogma 95 style contrasted with the inner life of Selma, the main character, which is kind of done in a different style, more fantastically, more musically, that contrast could have worked. But because it's being pulled in all these different directions, it's too many directions to be pulled to. And I think as a result, you no longer get contrast so much as just hodgepodge.
Yeah, at the same time, he still tries to make references to classic musicals. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's Catherine Deneuve from Les Demoiselles de Rochefort and Les Parapluies de Cherbourg, you know, this one French musical star, at least at the beginning of her career. And there's also the MC from Cabaret, yeah. which I didn't realize later on in a small role, Joel Grey. And somehow he's also like a fanboy for musicals, right? Mm-hmm. And then and adds that to the mix as well. But it doesn't feel at all like one of the musicals as he makes references to. The musical numbers with those cameras set up in every angle or any corner of a room or of a set, I mean, feel very odd at best. At the time, they might have felt like something musicals could become in the future. But now it's just very, very strange to see that type of video, late 90s video aesthetic, you know, make a musical in your own living room aesthetic types, and not really the grandeur or, like you say, the artifice of a really a dream world that is recognizably that. I guess that was part of the design as well, to make it feel somehow more connected between the real life scenes and the dream world that she's at, that sometimes you didn't quite know which was which. And I think one problem also comes with the music itself. I was a big fan of Björk at the time, listening to her mid-late 90s music and the big dramatic orchestral parts that were in them as well. And I think it's interesting to cast her in that role and to then have her style music take the lead. But of course, it's also not something that we're familiar with as a musical emotion to have Björk's music and herself in that role. And then to see that in the setup that von Trier made up, it feels just a very odd, unfamiliar mix that then doesn't correspond to any other musical that we've seen. So it just feels odd and unique, but somehow misplaced as well.
Absolutely. I mean, I do kind of respect it as an experiment, but for me, it is a failed experiment. I think I've watched later musicals that have a freshness, that have an experimental aspect that worked better for me. I think, for instance, when we did our last musical episode, we talked about the Polish musical film The Lure, which is basically a musical retelling of a grungy musical retelling of The Little Mermaid. That it uses modern pop and modern forms, and it does so in a much more coherent way. It's still eclectic. You still have the contrasts, but it still feels like one thing. With Lars von Trier, I don't think it quite works. And my impression actually at the time from what I remember was this was mostly a film, a musical that was appreciated by Lars von Trier fans who don't like musical, which doesn't have to be bad, but it made me think that does Lars von Trier understand what makes a musical work? And does he like musicals? You say that he's a fan, and there's an aspect of that. As you say, there's Catherine Deneuve, there's Joel Grey, there's the kind of Sound of Music metatext that's there the entire time.
Of course, yeah.
But at the same time, it feels like he's kind of making fun of musicals for something or other, but it's not quite clear what. So it feels muddled. And to again pick up on what you said about the musical fanboying, I think especially having Catherine Deneuve in this, it just makes me think of Le Parapluie de Cherbourg, which I think very much takes the musical format, puts it, uses both its artifice, but also the contrast, something realistic. It's basically a story that uses a certain baseline realism. It's set in the present day. It's basically a romance that fails because of, you know, political issues of the day, because of the Algerian war. Having the mundane and the hyper-real works in Le Parapluie de Cherbourg in a way that it doesn't work here. So every time she's on the screen, I think, yeah, I'd rather be watching a Jacques Demy movie now.
I can see that. Plus, also with just better music, more suitable music, songs that are really catchy and then take you into those hyper-real sequences and play them to fully dramatic effect. And I think it was also modeled here in terms of how the music was used and how it never really got to shine, how Björk is very eclectic in her musical or song build-up and how obviously it's recognizably hers, but it never goes beyond that, so it doesn't have the same impact that Michel Legrand has with his songs, for instance, that are standouts even outside the film. And maybe that's a connection that I made between the two films that we discussed today, that the lack of standout music to then put you back into the emotion of that experience is also very, very noticeable here. And I think Björk's performance, even though she's moving and she's very intense, and I think it's a great performance, but it will not be, or I don't think has been remembered as a great musical performance that puts you back into the emotion of that film, the experience, even though it tries to say something about capital punishment. Like you said, it tries to make us feel something about the unfairness of all that. I don't think it has had a lasting effect with that. It felt very much like that experiment that has Björk and her music in it, and then that's it. Or do you feel it had a cultural impact up until today?
It's difficult to say. I think Lars von Trier, his entire career, definitely, you know, as the bad boy of European cinema, I think he has had an impact in a sense that you can't get around him. You love him or you hate him. He's definitely remembered, and I think certain experiments he did are remembered. I know that Dancer in the Dark comes up on kind of best of lists fairly often, but even there I often have the impression it's more the respect for him trying something different, not necessarily for him succeeding at something different. The whole thing is of course also soured by Björk later accused von Trier, without mentioning his name, of sexual misconduct when the film was being made, and it sounds like that is very likely that all of that happened. And it's very much, you know, a Me Too story, not one of the worst ones, but that's just because what's out there is so bad in general that, you know, even if you're not one of the worst, you're still pretty bad. And I think reading that soured me on it even more.
I wasn't even aware of that story, to be perfectly honest, but the film certainly did at the time was put me off Lars von Trier's films. I literally didn't watch the next Lars von Trier films, even though I was interested at the time in Dogma, the films coming out, and I thought they were very powerful. But I tried somehow to, and it sounds odd, to protect myself from these films, to not having to be exposed to someone as manipulative or as honest. I'm not sure if that's the right adjective to use, but films that just shook you to the core. But somehow that was their intention, not necessarily always to portray or convey an important story and to talk about issues that they really cared for, but just to do that with their power of film. And in a way, I left Lars von Trier for many years because of Dancer in the Dark. I think it was really a turning away from that type of cinema at the time. Yeah, but hearing that, obviously, that adds another layer to it that, you know, where manipulation and misuse of power of a filmmaker, of course, has different layers then to them as well.
Mm-hmm. Which, you know, again, kind of ties back to a chorus line to some extent to the relationship there between Zach, the choreographer, and the dancers auditioning for him. And comparing those two films, I do think they make... At first, I thought it's just fun putting them together, ha-ha, you know, you've got the Lars von Trier musical, and you've got the 80s, hyper 80s, you know, stage musical. There are more things that you can look at in comparison, and I think in comparison, I would say that Dancer in the Dark is the more interesting film. It's the one that dares more, it's the one that has more teeth, but it's also the one that, in a way, I find more disappointing, because there is a lot there to like, except how the puzzle pieces are put together doesn't work for me at all. So it works less than it should work based on its individual parts. Whereas A Chorus Line is really the opposite. It basically, it aims for a certain kind of affable, mainstreamy quality, and it probably reaches that, and that's so little to kind of strive for.
And it's the one that is more harmless and more forgettable, I think, mm-hmm. when Dancer in the Dark then again, you know, kind of haunts you for a couple of days after you've seen it, just because you had to go through that again. Mm-hmm. But there is, I mean, after this talk especially, I see that very similar connection to basically manipulative films, men at microphones, men in director's chairs that say, okay, let's take this as far as we can because we can, mm-hmm. because we have the ability to say, you know, you're good, you're bad, thumbs up, thumbs down, or we have the power to take this into the worst possible outcome, and you have no chance of escaping unless you leave the cinema. So, I mean, there's a very odd meta connection between them. And I feel in those years between A Chorus Line and, you know, Dancer in the Dark, is that really what musicals still were, in a way, manipulative experiences by studios or producers or directors that just somehow did what they wanted in order to convey a certain worldview and to put that on us audiences. And whether there are more emancipatory musicals since, I'm not sure. I mean, you mentioned that one Polish example that I haven't seen yet, but where are musicals, or let's say unusual musicals, headed today? Have you had any other examples since 2000 that you would point out as, you know, musicals not just doing what they did before, or not being as manipulative? You have examples for that? Recommendations?
Yeah, there's this one musical that I think it was turned into a film in 2015 called London Road. I didn't particularly like it, but it's very interesting. And what it does, it's basically about real life killings of prostitutes in England. And what happened was they went to record what people said about this, witnesses, people who were involved, colleagues of the killed prostitutes. And then they took these recordings, real life recordings, and turned them into songs, taking the exact words, the stumbles, the ums and the arms, you know, a bit like in, you know, Aardman did these ads where they also interviewed, you know, the man on the street, and then basically animated those with kind of plasticine animals. So here it's again taking, you know, recording people vox populi style, and then using the exact words, the exact intonations, the exact rhythms, and turning that into songs. the result is songs that are completely not memorable because they sound like this weird mismatch between you just record people and then you turn that into songs. It's a bit like these kind of funny auto-tune memes where you just record someone and then you retune it a bit to turn it into song. It gives it a certain artifice where, again, I'm not quite sure I see the point of the artifice, but it's an interesting experiment. And it's less muddled than Dancer in the Dark. Although I would say Dancer in the Dark is the more interesting film. So that's London Road. I have to say one that I very much like that is very different from the two that we've seen. It's much more of a cinema vérité musical would be Once. I think that was in the perhaps around 2005. You know, where the kind of street musicians, the one from the Eastern Bloc and the Irish guy, they meet, they make music together, they fall in love, and it's all very low key. It's all very, realistic to some extent. They make music, so basically the music is not this artificial people bursting into song just because it's a musical. Again, it's a kind of musical that non-musical lovers would probably like, but I also think it works in and of itself. Because of the music, because of the songs, because of the characters and the actors. What about you? Do you have any modernish musicals you would recommend?
I really don't have like a list of films, of musical films since the 2000s that I was a huge fan of and that I somehow followed. I think there were some fantastic shows that I saw that have been turned into musicals. I'm thinking of Hamilton, which did something very unusual with telling American history through R&B rap songs and this cast of non-white people in roles of historic personalities. I think that worked wonderfully on stage. I haven't seen the film or the streaming version of it yet. But I must say I'm not someone to seek out a musical because it's a musical. I somehow avoided musical hits like La La Land, for instance, so far. I haven't seen it yet. I saw the opening and then said, this is not for me. So I must say I've been, not because of Dancer in the Dark, but it's not a genre that I look out for and that I have like favorites. I rather went back to more classic musicals. You know, I had a phase where I watched all the Gene Kelly musicals or the Vincente Minnelli productions, Liza Minnelli, watching her again, the Julie Andrews, the Angela Lansbury, obviously. You know, I have more personalities that I say, oh, I want to see that film and it happens to be a musical. And it has great songs. And I always complain about the fact that, there's classic musicals with great songs, but where are these songs these days? Is it really still a format that gives you the same wealth of songs that are long lasting? And I felt lately, films that had musical moments didn't really have memorable music attached to it that I would say, well, this is going to be listened to in so and so many years. Almost rather the Disney films that have done that more successfully, even though I'm also not someone to seek out those on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. So has Dancer in the Dark destroyed my love for my potential for musicals? Maybe. It certainly has done a lot and was interesting to see again the mechanisms of what happened back then that might have put me off both Lars von Trier and potentially, you know, musicals, but I'm not sure.
If you ever give La La Land a second chance or perhaps a one and a first half chance, I have to say I really like it. If I ever have to kind of defend it on the podcast, I will gladly do so. Mm. Obviously, it's very cliched in some ways, but I think it's savvy of the ways in which it is cliched. And I think it plays with the format quite nicely. We recently really enjoyed Wonka. And that one is kind of a stealth musical in the sense that the trailers try to hide that it's a musical, but it totally is a musical. It's not a fantastic musical. The songs are fun. The lyrics are witty, but it's not one that's going to, you know, stand the test of the ages. But it's still very enjoyable, especially if you need something to watch next Christmas, which is still a couple of months away, but it's very much a fun Christmas musical.
I have actually seen Wonka, and funny that you mention it now. I forgot about it, but at the time while watching it, I thought this is some of the most honest musical material that I've seen in a long time, mm-hmm. in a sense of that there were good solid songs mixed in obviously with the classic songs from the 70s from the original film, but it worked as a musical. I remember seeing it and thinking, this is the moments where I expect a good song to come in and expand on the story, go into fantasy aspects. And I think that's something that might be an interesting discussion also for future episodes or future second chances. What does a musical do in terms of timing? When is it time for those songs to come in? Because I feel that that's something that people love or dislike musicals for, is like, when do they break into songs and when does it really do something appropriate with a film lifting it and expanding on it? Or is it just, okay, it's time for another number and we wait until it's kind of over?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel Wonka did the exact right thing here in terms of timing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's an extremely well-crafted film, and obviously it lacks the kind of the experimental quality of some of the things we discussed now. But I think if you're looking for a classical, modern but classical musical that's fun and enjoyable, that's definitely one. I would be quite interested in seeing some of the Stephen Sondheim musicals adapted for film. I think some of them might be dated in the sense that I think they are very much 70s material. Something like Company, I think, for instance, I would love to see that, but I'm happy to just go back to the... there's a documentary about the recording of the cast album of that, which is a really good film. But I could imagine something like Sondheim's Assassin would actually be material that's very timely, because it's very much also about people who feel that they can't trust politics anymore. So they take, you know, things into their own hands, and they do so by shooting presidents and presidential candidates. I think it's a topic that you don't need to do much with it to make it present day. This idea of, you know, people who just can only express dissatisfaction with the world through violence, and how that is an essentially American sport almost. I could totally imagine a modern movie version of that that would be striking and shocking and effective, but it would have to be done really well.
Absolutely agree. I think this episode also made me want to go back to 80s musicals, you know, maybe to see Rent, maybe to see Fame, to see the musicals that also have this very, very deeply 80s quality, and to see if they work better on film, or at least to listen to... Because I realized that with The Chorus Line, I hadn't listened to the actual songs ever before, consciously. And to discover some of those aesthetics and origins of those musical shows, and to see if they work on film. Because I could imagine they could. I think A Chorus Line could have worked on film much better. But yeah, like you say, they need to be done really well. And probably they need an update. Just make them not suitable, sounds too PC, but just to be conscious about what they're actually telling, and to see if that can be told that way in the present day context. And I think then they could pack a punch and they could be powerful musical experiences, despite odd ones, mm-hmm. like the two we talked about today. Well, Matt, I think this is the moment to wrap things up. Thanks so much for talking about those two oddball musicals with me. I think we gained some fresh insights. Thank you to our listeners for joining us into second chancing some of the films that maybe we didn't want to, but now we did, and this is what came out.
Absolutely. I'm glad we don't have to do this in song, by the way.
Yes, absolutely. I was practicing, but then I gave up. Anyway, thanks, listeners. Join us again for another episode of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. Bye-bye.
Bye.